From the studios of Tucson Business Radio X, recorded in the Stewart Title corporate offices on Broadway, you are now listening to The Mark Bishop Show. And now here's your host, Mark Bishop.
Welcome to another Mark Bishop Show, and my guest, Lisa Sturz, the artistic director of Red Herring Puppets. It's a national touring company specializing in curriculum-based performances. She has an MFA in puppetry from UCLA and has taught at Cal Poly, Grinnell, and Warren Wilson Colleges, and led hundreds of in-school residencies. Bit of background on you. Welcome, Lisa.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Welcome to Tucson. I know you've just relocated. You're my special guest this morning, and for this episode, 40 years experience working in film, television, theater, and educational settings. Wow. You've worked with some of the who's who of the film industry, including Lucasfilm, Walt Disney Imagineering, Jim Henson Productions, NBC, PBS, The Ice Capades, the Lyric Opera of Chicago, the Field Museum, Shedd Aquarium, Silver Dollar City, Asheville Symphony, and many, many more. I could sit here all day, right? Yes?
There's a lot more.
There's a lot more. That's quite a resume, isn't it, Lisa?
It's been an interesting life.
Well, you've just moved to Tucson, really, and you're going to be setting up your own shop and mini theater in the Tucson Mall, I believe.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, as the owner and artistic director of Red Herring Puppets, you've been featured at the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta and the Puppet Showplace in Brooklyn, Massachusetts, and the first International Puppet Fringe Festival in New York City. I mean, what a thrill that must have been for you to do all of those.
Yeah, especially being in New York for that. We had several companies from Puerto Rico during the hurricane. I mean, it was just really an amazing experience.
Wow. Well, you've earned a California Emmy.
Yeah.
And UNIMA.
UNIMA.
UNIMA citation.
Yes, UNIMA is the International Puppetry. It stands for Union Internationale de la Marionnette. So it's kind of a big deal for us in the puppet industry.
Okay. So in your world, it's like, what can we liken it to? Academy Award.
Yeah, in our world. It's a much smaller.
I understand. In each world, and same as the radio world and podcasting world and television world, same thing. It's the biggest honor in American puppetry. How on earth did you first ever get into this art, Lisa? I mean, as a little girl, was it something that really took you by storm or what?
Well, actually, as a little girl, I did make puppets. There was a course offered at a community center, so I did make papier-mâché puppets and put on shows when I was really 7 or 8 years old, and I loved it. I was very shy, but not with a puppet, so it was very freeing, and I loved making things, but it really didn't, you know, strike me as something professional until I was in college. Mm. And then I was majoring in theater. I was also majoring in religious studies, but mostly because I was interested in Carl Jung and archetypes and more comparative religion, comparative mythology. And I was sent by the theater department to the National Theater Institute in directing. That was my major. And while I was there, I hurt my leg on the trampoline and couldn't do a lot of physical theater, which I'd been doing. Ooh. And there was a man doing puppetry, and I took his classes. And as soon as I walked into his home, I knew that that was what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
That's it. You just knew.
It was magical. He had his whole house was built on four-foot level, so a wall would fold down and become a rod puppet stage or a marionette stage. And he also fixed clocks, so he had at least 100 cuckoo clocks, and they were all set to a different time.
Oh,
so
boy.
There's this cacophony of trains coming out of the wall, and, you know, I just thought, okay, this
wow.
place
this is... This is something you'd see in a movie, huh?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
all those things going off, cuckoo, 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 coming out of the walls, and then trains, woot, woot.
It was pretty fun.
Could be known as a nutcase in some cases, but what a fun place for kids to go, huh?
Yeah, it was just, seemed to me to be a way to become an adult and still have a good life.
So what was your first schooling? Where did you go?
Well, I was at Grinnell College then, undergrad. And after that, I did a master's at the University of Connecticut because UConn is the center for puppetry. It's the only place you can do an MFA in puppetry.
Really? And yeah, of all the universities across America?
Yeah, you used to do one at UCLA, which is where I got mine. Mm-hmm. And I think the University of Hawaii used to have one, but it was really specifically in children's theater. Hmm. And so I went to UConn. I didn't technically get my master's in puppetry. I got it in experimental theater, but took every course there was in puppetry, and then did the MFA in puppetry at UCLA.
You know, I got to tell you, I would never have thought you could do a master's in puppetry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. It's great. It's an art. A hell of an art.
It gave me an opportunity, not just to learn a lot, and I was in a PhD program, so I really studied the history of puppet theater internationally for the last 3,000 years. But it's also an opportunity to work with other people interested in puppetry because they're not that easy to find.
I wouldn't imagine so. And seeing you touched on that, just for the hell of it, mm-hmm. when did puppetry start? Was it way back in the Greeks and the Romans, or was there some another way?
Well, the oldest that we've been able to trace it is about 2500 BC, Egypt. They found things in tombs. In terms of the Greeks, they did like the Bacchanalia. There were certain festivals and stuff that they did find puppets.
Hmm.
And they've actually found in South America, in some of the ancient tombs, they found terracotta figures and stuff. So
really? An ancient art, huh?
An ancient art.
There was something I read about the adult production of My Grandfather's Prayers. What was all that about?
Okay, so you probably know mostly people, when they think about puppetry, they often think about children, especially in the United States, not necessarily in other countries, but especially with the popularity of Jim Henson and the Muppets, it's become thought of as a children's art form.
Yeah.
But in Japan, for example, it's a national treasure to be a puppeteer there. And the adults go. It's like going to the opera. So it's a much more...
they've got a nice attitude if that's the case. Because, I mean, my mother loved the Jim Henson's Mob. I mean, she'd laugh her head off at that lot. And they were so clever. He was so clever.
And so a lot of things have been done for adults. So this show, My Grandfather's Prayers, that you mentioned, mm-hmm. is a show about my grandfather. And because I'm a puppeteer, it seemed like an obvious choice to me. He was a world-class cantor. He came from the Ukraine. He was a child prodigy. He got kidnapped when he was 7 years old. And the more I started to learn about his life, the more I was just fascinated and thought, my goodness, what an incredible story. And it spans the Russian pogroms, the white terrors in Budapest, where he was at the time. He was a chaplain in World War I. He came to the U.S. in 1923.
Wow.
And he actually was Leonard Bernstein's teacher, his first real mentor.
Really? Okay.
And because he was the cantor at the largest synagogue in Europe and made recordings in New York City for RCA and Victor Records. So I have those recordings and can hear this absolute world-class tenor. He did sing with the Hungarian Opera as leading tenor.
Right,
so
right.
Man could sing. And then, you know, you've got these quarter tones.
Well, that temple was spoiled, wasn't it? Huh?
Well, no. the great synagogue in Budapest has actually been fully restored. So it's...
And that's where he used to sing?
Yeah, he was the chief cantor there.
Wow, that's amazing. So you come from a bloodline of absolute top talent, don't you?
I guess so. I never knew my grandfather
right.
because he died before I was born. So it's been... You know, because I am an artist, like discovering the extent of his artistry and legacy really has been, it's been very grounding. And you'll see if you get to see that performance, I actually meet him I created these two-dimensional puppets shot against green screen.
Right.
I have pictures of him that I cut up and shot against green screen. So we actually interact.
Isn't that cool?
And
yeah, I'd love to see that, of course. Now, that was taped, right?
It was taped
and,
by
and
JLTV.
Shown, internationally, I believe.
Yes, but they haven't finished editing yet, so it has not aired yet. I'm going to L.A. next week, so hopefully there'll be some movement.
Okay. Now, you've got other film and TV credits, and I can relate to these shows, at least. Murphy Brown was one of my favorites.
Oh, that was
all
fun.
Right. Puzzle Place?
Do you remember that?
It was, no,
it
that
was
one
PBS.
I don't.
Yes, it was a...
Well, of course, I was in Australia, Gray, so I wouldn't remember that one. But I do remember Elmo in Grouchland.
Yes, that was one of the Muppet movies that I worked on.
Okay, Muppets from Space?
Yeah.
Howard the Duck?
Remember that one?
Nope.
Based on comics, it was a George Lucas film. It was one of the biggest flops, I think, of the film industry. It was like it won some award for being in the top bottom films. But actually, it has a big comeback now. I think they're even, it was based on a comic, and I think they're, I heard rumors that they're actually doing another Howard the Duck movie. So the one that we did is coming back.
Howard the Duck, we'll come back on that. But the Flintstones.
The Flintstones.
Know that well. Ninja Turtles 3.
Yeah, it was Splinter.
Right. Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
Roger
yeah.
Rabbit. So when, to give us an idea with some of these, if you wouldn't mind. You know, what your involvement was. And I'll touch on Gremlins 2, RoboCop 2, and Batman Returns. Now, between all of those that I've mentioned, just give us a little sliver of...
Well, I'm going to give you a sliver of one that I didn't mention. It was the first film that I did.
Okay.
And it was Captain EO and the Space Knight. So it was Michael Jackson, and it was George Lucas producing it. And Francis Coppola directing it. So this was my first experience. It was a pretty good first experience.
Not a bad crew, huh?
So basically what I do, if anyone's seen Captain EO, was at Disneyland. It was so we interact with the characters. We rehearse with them. We do improvs with them and getting ready. But it's great working on film. It's a very different thing from live theater.
Right.
I've gotten a lot of training through Henson. I've gone through all their workshops.
Mm-hmm. Did people come all over the world to go to his workshops?
Yes. And big auditions, you have to be invited. But I think the way you get invited is, you know, you can send your resume, you can send a reel, you can send...
This is not necessarily to get to work on one of his
films
or show. Oh, it is. I'm getting it just to even how to do puppetry correctly.
Right. Well, how to do, I'd say the best place really to learn is there's an organization called the Puppeteers of America, and they do festivals every year. Every other year, it's a national festival. In the in-between years, it's a regional festival.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost always workshops in puppet manipulation, in puppets on camera. Actually, the last festival was this summer in Minneapolis, and I was the workshop director, so I organized all the workshops for the festival. And we definitely included that in...
Right.
The training that you can get.
So when you open up here very soon at the Tucson Mall.
At the Tucson Mall.
Okay. Are you going to be teaching as well?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that. I would definitely want to train a few people. I'm hoping, now that I've moved here, I'm hoping we'll be able to get some commercial work, some television work. And I'll need to train some people so that, you know, if we have a situation and it needs two or three characters at the same time, there are other people who have that skill.
All right. Well, I'll use you firstly. I've got an idea for a little video.
Okay.
To do, so. Now, how do you do all your different voices? How do you keep tuned for that? I mean, that's a talent. I mean, you know.
That's one of the skills. Often what I'll do is I'll look at the character and try to make my face in the same shape as the character.
You know, you could put the voice like all the way in the back of your throat. Hey, you could put the voice really, really, really high up at the very top.
Or you can go down.
Oh, boy.
You can do accents. I like to do New Jersey accents because I'm kind of from there, so it's pretty easy. You know, and change your rhythm, change your cadence. And
very good. And the range is amazing. Practice, practice, I bet, huh? What was it like? What was your favorite show? Now, hang on a minute. We've got films as one thing, but when we're talking about working on kiddie shows, I mean, those two characters up in the balcony on the Muppets.
Oh, yeah.
They got me in fits, those two, right? Now, was it more enjoyable working on, say, the Henson-type stuff versus films?
Well, one thing great about the Muppet shoots that I've done is the puppeteers are so good. And you wouldn't believe what happens when the camera's not rolling.
I wouldn't put it past anybody. At least it'd be fun going to work there, wouldn't it?
It is fun. And, I mean, I can really appreciate how hard it is. I mean, I don't think people realize the skill that it takes. It's like being a primo ballerina. The level of training, the level of musculature in your hand, in your fingers, in your arms.
Well, that was the next thing I was going to ask you, because people just think, you know, we talk puppets, but there's Muppets, and we talk people imagining holding strings.
The marionettes.
The marionettes. And then you've got, what, life-size?
I've life-size. I've built 40-foot figures.
Wow.
But there's rod puppets, there's shadow puppets.
So how do you work? And what's the ones that you put on your hands?
You're probably, the ones people are most familiar with are, I mean, we can't call them Muppets because that's copyrighted.
Okay.
They're technically hand and rod puppets because your hand is,
all right.
Or some people say mouth puppets.
Okay.
Now, they're
short. They come over your hand, down over your wrist, I would imagine, right?
Yeah.
And that's where you're talking about now having to be this flexible with your fingers?
With your fingers, with every muscle, especially if you're doing lip sync, with, you know, making the puppet talk.
Sure. Do you ever get cramps? I mean...
I've been pretty lucky, but I stay in shape,
okay.
And I do exercise my hands.
With your hands, yeah.
And as much as possible. When you're on a film set, you sometimes have your arm in the air for 14 hours. So taking care of yourself and making sure when the camera's not rolling, if they're just lighting, to try to take a break whenever you can.
No, I can relate to that. I once had a lead in a movie, Face in a Wall. And it was pretty horrible. All they did was chop a round ring out of a concrete wall. And I had to put my face into that with a skin over the front of it that was coming through. And there were times where they weren't shooting and chatting and this and that, but I was still stuck there with it underneath my neck. And that feeling is horrible when you can't move. So when your arm's up in the air for all that time with the blood running down, I can imagine it's painful. People don't know these sorts of things go on. You
right.
Know, that's
and
it.
I've done shoots where it was, I think it was on... Batman Returns, we were doing penguins, and we were in a set that was kept at a temperature that was good for the penguins. So it was freezing.
Ah.
And they would forget about us. You know, they would think that the penguins, they'd forget there were puppeteers down there.
Yeah.
And they would call lunch. We wouldn't find out. We'd have our, you know, we're sitting there shivering. And it's in L.A., so then you go outside and it's, you know, 90 degrees.
Right.
So,
and the penguins got it all, but you got left flat. Heavens
we're above. Under the table in the garbage can behind the wall.
How do you lip sync perfectly? Well, what's the secret?
Well, it's easiest when you're also doing the voice, but often, especially if you're doing it to a song, or a lot of times I've puppeteered characters that were played by men, you know, where I didn't do their voice, so I had to coordinate with them and practice with the actor if you're not doing the voice yourself.
So how do the actors like that? I mean, they're real and human. Here they are talking with puppets.
And what doesn't work is if we do it first and then they bring the actor in to, you know, to ADR to do the sound, the voiceover after.
Okay.
That doesn't work. What works is if we have their recorded tape to perform to.
Okay.
You know, then we can be much more specific and clear.
So you must use a monitor.
Yes. The monitor is crucial for television.
So that's
puppetry.
Out of sight. For instance, if you were a puppet at the end of the table now,
yeah.
Okay, pretty, I don't have cameras on this, but I'm getting there. The point is, I would be talking to a puppet.
Correct.
You would be under the table.
I would be under the table looking
at a monitor.
On your knees,
at a comfortable position somehow, right?
It depends, yeah, on a stool, on a wheel, on a blanket. For some of these big Muppet shoots, they actually build the entire floor, they, you know, with 4x8s,
wow.
And they pick them out as the camera rolls, like if the dolly is going towards you, they actually have people removing sections of the floor so the puppeteers can be walking and have the puppet be
at
floor level.
What a great idea. Yeah, that makes sense.
Most shoots I've been on don't have that luxury.
No, the budget to do that, ripping floors up, I guess. So you're looking at the monitor, which is actually showing me interviewing you then.
Correct.
So you answer just like you'd be sitting there live then. That's what makes it perfect.
It takes some getting used to, especially because you have to understand, too, that it's not like looking in a mirror because the image is reversed.
Uh-huh.
So you might think you're going to the right, but you're going to the left.
You're going to the left.
And
think about that one. You
know. It can play. That's one of the things I find new puppeteers have a really hard time with. How do you stay centered in the camera? Because constantly what your body is used to doing is the opposite of what you need to do.
You know what I can liken that to?
Backing up a boat into a...
Driving in America. Because in Australia, of course, we drive on the other side of the road. So does Europe. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's only you guys that have to do it back to front.
I've done it the other way around. I'm not very good at it.
It takes a bit of thinking, but you get used to it. But I still, even after 20-odd years, there's only one or two times when I could lose just that 1 second. And it's usually coming out of a shopping center or coming out of something specific where it was easy for us to go straight left, you know, into the wrong lane head on versus going out right to cross the road and get to the other side again. So there we go. I liken driving to puppets. So, see, you were meant to be this. I mean, I'm a great believer in you're meant to be meant to do what you love doing. And I would love to see more people do what they're meant to do, you know, if they could do that. Now, you mentioned making, by the way, if you've just joined in and listening to the show, I'm lucky enough to have Lisa Sturz, Lisa Amy Sturz, in fact, and she is the artistic director and owner and CEO and chief cook and bottle washer and everything else of Red Herring Puppets, about to open up here in Tucson. Aren't we lucky? Oh, it's going to be fantastic at the Tucson Mall, and kiddies are going to be able to go, and adults, and there's going to be a little theater there, and you're going to see some of the best, which is, you know, when you can work with whom she's worked with, I tell you what, we're lucky to be able to go there live. And you might even, there may be a chance, you might even get to learn how to do puppetry. So I thank you for the time you're giving us today, Lisa. That's very good. Now, you said you make puppets.
I do.
Okay. What are they made of?
Well, that's a pretty broad question. So the simplest ones are shadow puppets, and they're made out of paper or a poster board. And often I work on overhead projectors, in which case they're made out of acetate and contact paper and markers. So that's kind of, those are the two-dimensional puppets.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, well, I'll just take it to then like hand puppets. And most, if I was working with kids, probably we'd use a paper pulp or a paper mache to do the heads and cloth bodies. I often use neoprene, which is a synthetic latex. So we sculpt it in clay, make a plaster mold.
Gosh, truth. This is an art within itself, isn't it? Doing all of this.
Yeah. Then the capillary action of the plasters, you know. I like neoprene because it doesn't break and the rats don't like to eat it.
Oh, that's very important.
They do like paper mache. So if I want something to last for a while.
So with your shop, you're going to have a workshop.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
You're going to be building and doing, I mean, that. To learn all that stuff, I mean, that was an art in its own right. Then you use them. That's a nice thing, and to build something yourself and then actually use it. Why the Tucson Mall?
That's a great question. When I first arrived, or even before I arrived, I've been in touch with arts organizations, with schools, trying to understand how things work in Tucson and where I might fit in. And one of the most exciting responses I got was from SACA, which is the Southern Arizona Arts and Cultural Alliance. And they were very excited that a puppeteer was coming, that they're, you know, they felt that they needed more puppetry in Tucson. And so I met with them when I got here, and they are opening up a 14,000 square foot space in the Tucson Mall. They're going to have workshops, gallery, theater space. They even have a multimedia like production studio in the back with sound booths. And the people working with SACA have just been so welcoming and so kind.
So it's a win-win, really. It gives SACA an opportunity for their members and for people of the arts throughout Tucson to be able to go somewhere and perform and have somewhere to be, you know, connected with that way.
They're going to be doing some amazing things.
Amazing stuff there. And the mall wins because I guess it's like an anchor. It's a major puller for them.
To bring
people in.
Online
has affected all of that.
Yeah. And they're trying to really re-envision the Tucson Mall as a community center.
Right.
I mean, of course, there's going to be retail, and
but
this is in addition to, and I think, again, it'll all help each other. And I'm not going to be in Saka's space. They're having a 14,000 square foot space of their own. I'm actually moving into the office space that they are using until their space is ready.
I see. Okay.
And that should be this week, actually.
Well, I hope it works for them. It should do.
Yeah.
And it's different. It's challenging. And I think you'll be packing it with what you do. And by the time they get their act together and start doing performances and so on, it could be a nice area. Plenty of parking.
It's safe.
Plenty of parking. There's a lot of good things about it, right? Yeah. More marketing to be commended on that then. Very good indeed. What do you plan to do in your particular studio itself? Now, we understand you're going to, you know, make some puppets and you're going to do some shows. Maybe what, 50 seats, 100 seats? How does it work?
Probably more like 50.
50, okay.
I'm not actually in the studio yet, so it's a little hard for me.
A little difficult for you to plan.
But I have done little models and little scale drawings and moving things around, trying to figure it out. Certainly, first and foremost, I will set up a wood shop. With my bandsaws and table saws, and for all the woodworking, and I'll have another area for. I have about 5 different sewing machines, so for construction. And I do. I think you saw I do some large figures for museums and aquariums. I've done several 20-foot figures, so I work with sheets of foam for that, so I need big tables where I can pattern.
Let's talk about that while we're on that. We talk about 20-foot figures.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
The abdominal snowman or something. I mean, what do you make? What are they? I mean, are these big enough where you actually go inside them?
Well, for example, I built a T-Rex and a Triceratops for the Field Museum in Chicago. And it was, Sue is their T-Rex skeleton that they have in Chicago. So it was her birthday. And so this was a big celebration. And these figures were worked by 3 puppeteers. They're huge foam figures that are covered with fabric, and they have a whole internal structure that attaches to rods that I use painter's rods so I can screw them in or take them out. And so they can walk through.
It's literally walking.
Yeah, I mean, I've done figures like that for parades.
Okay. I can imagine that, yeah.
When the Shedd Aquarium opened up their shark exhibit, I built several 20-foot figures, and they did technically parade through Chicago, and they had a big outdoor celebration.
Whoa.
And the puppets were dancing. So
cool. In some cases, it frightened the devil out of little kids, wouldn't it? Sharks and...
You occasionally scare a few, but usually
it's fun.
Not. But
it's fun and laughter, I guess, and you'll be doing that there. So when you... what brought you to Tucson?
What brought me here is my husband, his mom and 2 of his sisters live here, and we were here over Christmas last year, and he's just, I need to be here. I need to be close to my family. So, and because we've got 2 kids who at the time were in LA, now one of them is moving to New York, but that also was a draw. It's like, it's much easier to see our children this way.
Yeah, well, my wife, she's originally from New York, too.
From
Valley
York.
Stream, actually, in Long Island.
Long Island.
Long Island.
All right.
But came out here when they were 12, when she was 12, because of her mom was pretty sick at the time, and it's a great weather place for people to come out with bad arthritis and so on. And other complaints, but Dad picked up the kids and brought them out in the middle of, talking 75 Tucson here, you know, it's like a western town, I guess, just boom, in the middle, and here we are. And she worked in corporate America all over the place, saw a lot of America, then we met on a cruise, actually, and lived in Australia, in the islands of Australia and New Zealand. We worked together as our company, and it was very interesting. We traveled, but we've come back for family, too. We came back 6 years ago, and a lot of people leave Tucson, but I'm sure it's the mountains and the magnetic mountains that bring everybody back, whether they're the Rincons or the Catalinas, it doesn't matter. There's so many people I have met who have been away, done their thing, seen the world, worked around America, whatever, but have come back to Tucson, you know, come back to live. So you're one of that mob.
I guess I'm one of them. Mark's father settled here. He worked for IBM, and he did work all over the world, was stationed in Hong Kong, but came, that was his last job, and loved it here, and they stayed.
Yeah. So you think, and you're from where the origin, well, Alabama, weren't you just living there?
No, I grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey,
right
outside the Holland Tunnel. And, you know, my dad worked in Manhattan. Then I went to school in Iowa and in Connecticut. I actually, Grinnell is in Iowa. And then I lived in Jordan in the Middle East for a year and directing their national puppet theater.
They
have a puppet theater in Jordan.
So what's it like living in a place like that?
In Jordan? Boy, it was different being a woman too. Being a woman and being in a like official
position. And an artistic position to boot.
That was tricky. My women friends taught me, I mean, you know, I learned some Arabic, and they taught me to quote from the Quran and things that would protect me. Because, you know, there was an assumption, you're an American woman, you must be...
Well, not only that, you're Jewish. You know,
there is that.
That as well, sort of thing.
But I didn't tell anybody that. It's illegal to be Jewish in Jordan.
Is it really?
Yeah. But then you find out that everybody's got a Jewish grandmother or, you know, because there was a lot of...
On the quiet, yeah. And like that, nobody drinks, but they all go down to a certain club on the ocean, right? All that type of thing. That's the Hippocratic
Oath, isn't
it?
But I did need to be careful. But, you know, like anywhere, there are good people and bad people and... I hung out with the good ones.
So there you go. But what an experience. Evil of life. It's fabulous, you know. But puppetry. Tell us a little bit about the puppetry in Jordan then.
Well, I was working for the Haya Art Center, and actually Queen Noor, I met her. King Hussein, you know, was my boss. My paycheck was from the king.
Mm-hmm.
but one thing that was amazing is we did a show. Because Jordan was a nomadic country, it didn't really exist until, you know, when the State of Israel was created, mm-hmm. they kind of sectioned off Jordan.
Right.
So there's no real history like there is in Egypt. There's, you know.
Thousands of years, yeah.
Thousands of years. So mm-hmm. they were trying to create a history, really, a folklore for Jordan. So we mm-hmm. were creating characters that were indigenous to Jordan to kind of start some sort of Jordanian identity. And we would take these shows into these tiny little villages, and we'd have to bring a generator. There was no electricity. They'd never seen television. They didn't know what it was. And for the first 5 minutes, often the kids were screaming, not with fear, but just with like aliens had landed on their planet.
Wow. You put yourself in their shoes, it'd be just like that.
Yeah.
To the outside world.
Yeah.
You're listening to Tucson Business Radio X here in Tucson, broadcasting live from the Stewart Title Building, the corporate headquarters on Broadway. It's the closest I'll get to Broadway anyway. In-house joke.
You are currently listening to The Mark Bishop Show, broadcasting from the Stewart Title Studio on Broadway in Tucson, Arizona. Back to the show.
It's The Mark Bishop Show, and my special guest is Lisa Amy Sturz, wonderful puppeteer, and has moved to Tucson. I guess if wherever you hear this, if you're visiting Tucson, because we do go all over the world, by all means, get to the Tucson Mall when you come, and you go and have a look at the Red Herring puppets. It'll be fun. Is there anything you'd like to share with somebody maybe who's listening would love to do what you've done? How do they start? Where do they go? Can they come and talk to you at least to start? Or?
Well, at least they can talk to me. And I would say, you know, I mentioned before the Puppeteers of America. It's an incredible organization.
Where is it based?
It's not really based anywhere. Their corporate headquarters are in Atlanta at the Center for Puppetry Arts.
Oh, okay.
But it's just like that's where the mail comes from. It's more the national festivals usually move so that they're not in the same place every year.
Okay. Move around, right.
And then because there's regional festivals in between, I'm hoping to do a regional festival here in Tucson at the mall. Use
that
the
Saka
space, and the Arizona Rose Theater has a theater there, you know, try to do something there. But to get involved, locally, there's an Arizona Puppetry Guild. There's the Great Arizona Puppet Theater in Phoenix. And there's a few puppeteers here that I've met, and we've met a couple times. Mm-hmm. See if we can coordinate stuff with the puppet theater in Phoenix, maybe do some adult puppetry slams, maybe offer some classes. Hmm. If people want to, what a puppetry slam is, it's usually short form, 3 to 5 minute pieces. So if somebody wants to try puppetry and right. they don't want to commit to, you know, an hour long production,
sure, yeah.
They can just try out an idea.
And give it a shot. So it's comedy.
Often, doesn't have to be.
Right. So it's I'm trying to visualize here. It's like maybe one could get up at a club instead of doing a comedy act.
Right. It's like stand-up.
You might do puppet stand-up.
You might do, and it might, you know, it often is comic, but it's definitely not the rule. People have done very serious pieces as well for mm-hmm. these puppetry slams. Really, right. sometimes the slam will have a particular theme.
Right. Okay.
But not necessarily.
So you would actually make the puppets.
Oh, yeah.
According to the theme.
Yeah.
And make
yeah.
it very, very real.
Or if you just have a, you know, an idea, a song, a funny dream that you've had that you think would be great to do right. as a puppet show. Just experiment. Just have fun. You know, we slams, you don't have to take yourself too seriously. It doesn't have to be brilliant. It,
mm-hmm. Isn't that funny? I had a funny dream last night, you know.
See?
And maybe because I knew I was interviewing you the next day. it was a weird dream, and I'll share it with you because I just think it might fit with this. I was left, I don't know by whom, uh-huh. but I was left this property. It was a lovely big block of land. But when and I was told there was a little house on it. So, okay, the saying is a little house on it, all right. I get to this property with my wife, and we're looking for the house. And it's a tiny little thing in the corner of the land. And there's just enough to have a card table in there and four seats around it, right? Like pygmies live there or something. I just think it could be Puppet House now. uh-huh. That was weird, so I got to figure that one out. But there we go. See, puppets get carried around in what? In cases?
In cases, in plastic bags, in sewn bags, in trunks, and yeah.
When you were a little girl growing up and we used to watch these guys on television, on the Tonight Shows and all of that, who was ever, did you have a favorite? A guy that used to be maybe a ventriloquist?
Oh, I remember, like, there was Topo Gigio on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah, he was good.
But, you know, it's funny, I really didn't grow up. I mean, you know, I'm older, so Sesame Street wasn't playing when mm-hmm, I was growing mm-hmm. up. One of the first shows was Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. I didn't actually see the show as a kid, but Bert Tilstrom, who's the creator, I met Burr, and I got to work with him, and he actually did a show just for me one time, which was fantastic.
Isn't that lovely? I'm just fascinated with the art itself, how huge it really is. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, unless you're in the game, but there's so many ways you could use all of your figures. You know, I mean, television, stage, radio, theater. I mean, it's no end.
Really, there's something that happens. I call it the numinous quality of the puppet, which, you know, the numinous is sort of the kind of a spiritual aspect to the puppet. Mm-hmm. In traditional puppetry, like Indonesia, for example, they consider the puppets to be sacred.
Oh, really?
And they felt that the puppets contained the souls of their dead ancestors.
Oh, my God, right.
And it was kind of connected to the rice culture of the kernel of rice from one crop is what, you know, feeds the next generation. So they had that same kind of attitude. And it was the priest who was the puppeteer. And the last thing they would do would be carve the eye, and that endowed it with this spirit. And so you literally, they wouldn't allow you to sit on the box where the puppets were stored. They were afraid it would bring catastrophe to the village. And these shows that they performed were very specific to certain healing things. If someone had, you know, well, I don't know, cancer back then, but a broken mm-hmm. arm, or they had specific shows that they did.
Wow.
And, you know, it was all timed with the orchestra, with the gamelan. So there's this sacred quality to it. And even in Egyptian and in Greek, the ancient
right.
forms. So for me, that there's something puppets can reach, I believe, deeper than a human can. Like with a puppet on my hand, I can get away with stuff. I can, you know, say things to people that I would never say as a human.
That's right.
And people will laugh.
When you think about it, you're right.
It's just like there's something magical that happens, and anything's possible.
Well, you wouldn't want, would you do one where they're banging each other's head sort of thing, or knocking each other out? Because how would they get on then spiritually? You can't do that.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I don't know, you've ever seen the Punch and Judy shows, which
are
very popular.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
And so, you know, those at, in the beginning, they were political theater. It was a way of protesting against authority. And so people would cheer because, you know, if you know anything about the Punch and Judy shows, mm-hmm. who do they, it's the hangman, it's the policeman, it's the doctor, it's like figures in authority. And it was kind of the peasant's way of saying, let's, you know, get rid of the law. Let's get rid of the aristocracy.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know, so there was a little bit of a...
You don't touch on politics, do you?
I touch on politics. In fact, my husband is a management consultant, but at a time, was kind of during the Occupy movement, being sensitive about income disparity. So he wrote a book called Deep Economics, which basically looks at the United States as a corporation and saying, and he did this on his own, it's not like the government hired him, you know, saying, are we in alignment with our values?
Right.
What are our values? Liberty, justice for all.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, then how? Where did things go off? How do we get back on track? How do we become who we say we are?
Interesting. What's his name?
His name is Mark.
Oh, Mark,
like yours.
With
Mark.
A K?
He's Mark Blessington.
No, Mark.
But so what we did is we did a show called Greed that was based, and we did a whole section on Beware of Delaware and the Lords of Chancery.
So how did that go down?
Great. It was really.
I don't normally touch them, but we don't. You know, a lot of media leans left or right. We tend to lean business at Tucson Business Radio X, but my show itself, I don't really like to touch on politics much either. I'm sort of down the middle, but I had to ask you that because I see puppets being, you know, the idiots that they are. You know,
political. And I'd say in the show that we did, it's not like right or wrong or right or left.
That's
it's
it.
More,
you know,
this is the economy. These are the facts. This is how we got there. And.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine a couple, though, you know, all the left on side and the right side, and they'll bash at each other, even in the Congress.
I did do the Supreme Court as Jack in the Box. I had all these boxes that opened up and had the Supreme Court, because during FDR, Ishmael with a Stitch in Nine saves time. It was the Supreme Court had actually knocked down the New Deal,
mm-hmm.
even though there was 85% popularity, so that was... Then FDR said, "Okay, I'll appoint more justices and I'll set a time limit." They're like, "No, no, it's okay. We'll institute the New Deal."
When you look back at all of your life, mm-hmm. is there anything that really stands out that, as far as you're concerned, it's your number one favorite?
Well, as you said, that something popped up. So I guess that's what I should tell you. I did The Ring with the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and those familiar with The Ring, and there's four operas that consist the Ring cycle, and I worked on all of them, and I had a 40-foot dragon that was in Siegfried, and Siegfried slays the dragon,
mm-hmm.
and for that I had 17 puppeteers, we cast.
Wow, so you directed them.
I directed them, I staged it, and worked with the music, and when we presented it to Zubin Mehta was the conductor for the opera.
Mm-hmm.
And I was nervous. Zubin was a household name for me growing up. So when we did it for them, Zubin, first he said to his assistant conductor, "You conduct, I want to get back there so I can watch it." And so he went in the tech booth with me, mm-hmm. and he was jumping up and down clapping. And he hugged me and said, "That's the best dragon I've ever seen."
Yeah. You've got footage of this at all? You've got any film?
I have some pictures of it.
Yeah, I'd love to see that sometime.
You know, because all these things are copyrighted with the opera singers and stuff, I don't.
Right.
I have some rehearsal.
Pretty strict
tapes.
In your world, huh? In the big league.
Yeah. Yeah, we had world-class singers, you know, the top Wagnerian.
Well, you've had some incredible experiences. So that was your favorite professional,
it was
artistic involvement, doing that, directing that dragon
and
in
I
Chicago.
And I loved working in the opera because, like, I had an idea for
Well,
Rheingold.
That's live. Now we're talking live stage.
Yes, yes.
So that's one medium.
Yes.
Other than, what about the other mediums? Television or smaller live stages?
Yeah, I've pretty much done it all. And I've also worked a lot in educational settings, you know, like you said, doing these curriculum-based shows.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because that's interesting for children.
So I try, one thing very important to me is content. That if I don't have anything to say, then why am I saying it? So I love working with children, but I like there to be a reason. So, for example, one of our most popular children's shows, the one that won the Unum Award, mm-hmm. is Aesop's Fables.
Ah, and good old Fables. That's been around since donkeys,
hasn't it? I don't moralize. I don't, like, say, and thus that means that, you know, because okay. kids can figure that out.
Yeah, they're not silly.
But I love doing that show. But to me, it really is about something. It's about treating your neighbors mm-hmm. well. It's about kindness. It's about little beings can achieve great things.
Yeah, great message in there. Yeah, so the spirit
to me,
of the thing.
Yeah. And then I have a show called The Big Dipper, Calendar, Compass, and Clock. And it shows how in The Big Dipper can be used to tell time and to watch the seasons. So I took myths from many different cultures. In that show, I've got China, I've got the Mi'kmaq Indians in Nova Scotia, I've got a Greek story, and we also do the Underground Railroad, the story of, you know, the slaves following the drinking gourd.
Amazing.
To the north. And that show has a lot of science content and a lot of history. I have a show about electricity, which traces the history of electricity and magnetism.
Now, these people, for anybody listening, you know, we're talking puppets here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You've just talked about so many stage settings and designs and outfits and uniforms for these puppets. I mean, you make all this.
I do.
Wow.
And tell you write what. The scripts, tell the stories, often work with musicians.
Fantastic. If anybody who's listening would love to do what you really want to do, what's the biggest advice you could give them?
Join the Puppeteers of America. Find out about your local puppet guild. Just start making puppets. There's stuff online you can follow. Just experiment.
So if one these days, of course, does one just Google puppets?
You can Google puppets.
Never know what you come up with. Now, your site, speaking of that, online... Your site is what? Red Herring?
RedHerringPuppets.com.
I got to ask you, what on earth is Red Herring?
Oh, I have to tell you then. Okay. So I was in the PhD program at UCLA, and I was majoring in puppetry. And they don't, there's really not a lot of classes in puppetry, you know, for the PhD student. Mm-hmm. It's more Ibsen and modern realism and Asian theater. And so whatever I was taking, I would...
All that boring stuff.
Yeah. Well, but so I'm taking my orals, mm-hmm. and during the orals, they're saying, oh, you took a course in modern realism, so how would you do Chekhov with puppets? And I said, well, I wouldn't. I don't think puppets lend themselves well to that. They're like, answer the question, how would you do it? So I'm like, okay, well, I'd have a big samovar, and I'd have all these people and characters and things come out of the samovar, and I probably wouldn't use any words. And, you know, so they're like, And
right.
then they're like, well, what define puppetry? And I would say something, and they would be arguing amongst themselves, and then someone said, well, according to you, this chair could be a puppet. I'm like, it could. And they're like, well, what kind of puppet would it be? And I said, it would be a chair puppet.
There you go.
So they flunked me on my orals. And I had a 4-point average. So it was, it became this, some of the professors were saying, this is ridiculous. She's one of our best students.
Exactly. They're only jealous.
So basically what happened is they kicked me out of the PhD program and said I was a red herring. But they transferred me to the MFA program, which is equivalent to a PhD. So I got my MFA instead of PhD.
There you go. And look where you went on from there anyway.
Well, and the MFA is equivalent, but it's in performance. And they're kind of, a lot of the argument was around if you're a PhD student, how do you get to do your performance? Which is why I was there. They were making an exception. Mm. They're like, MFAs get to do a performance, PhDs get to write papers. I'm like, well, I want to do both.
Yeah, I can remember when I did my PhD, I tell you, heavens above, from UHK.
What was your PhD in?
Life. You are UHK, University of Hard Knocks, yes. You know. Okay, now, we know about Red Herring now. Okay, so we use that as the site. What can can one pretend to find there on the site?
Well, there's a really broad look at the scope of what I do. And because I've been doing it for so long, you can see collaborations with museums and operas. You can see touring shows that I
So you've got plenty of shots. Excellent already. And you want anything else? Facebook and all that jazz, you know?
Yes, I have to get more active. I have all those things. I do have a Red Herring Puppets Facebook page. Have an Instagram account. I have to start using it more, especially with having a site, a shop.
Well, you're new into town. I'll introduce you to one of my clients who has a great show on this channel, on Tucson Business Radio X. And they have a lot of listeners because they teach social media. And two busy gals, actually. And they have a show called Ask the Gals, Jessica Badowski and Lisa. And they do a marvelous job. And they really know their stuff.
Great.
And they teach. So I'll introduce you to them. And they can help you out with that. So we've got a website at the LinkedIn, Jazz. You're using that? Everybody's jumping on LinkedIn, too.
I have a LinkedIn site, but
You've got to find time. Okay. You're busy doing stuff. You know what I mean? This day and age, to be a solo entrepreneur, there's just not enough hours in a day. You know? One has to hire all these other people and do things as well. It's been an absolute thrill. Is there anything? Let me ask you one last question. I want to bring one in out of left field.
Okay.
Because you're very intelligent. I mean, nothing stops you. I've noticed that. If you look back, is there anything that if you could make the choice again or the decision could be made again, you would do differently?
I think there were a couple of little turning points that I had to make choices. One was when I was at UConn. That's just when Jim Henson was getting started with the Muppets, and they kind of put out a general notice, does anybody want to work with Jim Henson and the Muppets? And at the time I thought, well, I want to do my own work. That's why I do, why would I want to work for someone else? This is before Jim was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of wonder, well, what would have happened had I done that? Another one like that is, Julie Taymor, who did The Lion King on Broadway.
Wow.
And she did The Magic Flute at Lincoln Center. I knew Julie. She kind of invited me to go to New York and build Lion King or be in charge of the shop. And with Michael Curry, who works often with Julie. And I turned it down. Because I was just moving to North Carolina. My kids were young. I didn't know what the New York City schools were like.
And
I just felt like, I don't really want to live in New York City. So those were turning points where
I necessarily regret the
choices that I made. And I loved raising my kids on a farm.
So you're a mom too,
Yeah.
Amongst everything else, you're a mom.
Yeah, and that was more important to me.
Look how talented you lot are. Huh?
Giving the kids a good life. But I think, in a way, I feel like that chapter can be completed now in Tucson. It's a bigger city than Asheville, North Carolina. So I'm hoping that maybe...
You'll finish it off.
Yeah, that's what
it comes around, It comes around. Might be 40 years later, but it comes around. And then you can finish things off. I understand that. It's been an absolute pleasure having you. Lisa Amy Sturz is the artistic director and owner of Red Herring Puppets. You're going to hear a lot about them in Tucson. And I hope you enjoyed the show and listening to Lisa and learning about Lisa and meeting Lisa on The Mark Bishop Show and wherever you may be. And if you get to Tucson, please get to the Tucson Mall and go and say hello.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.